Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity, really, to come back to Dublin and to experience your fine summer weather. when Arne, Justin and I first started talking about this session, we were trying to, you know, I don't know how you guys feel, but through much of the last 2 years, I have felt like that guy out there. If you're an executive director, a CEO of a civil society organization, it's almost felt like you're all alone, you're battling the elements, there's nowhere to go for help, succor, sustenance, advice, or even just sympathy. One of the things we're hoping is that today you will have the opportunity to simply bare your soul and tell us what it feels like. But what I'm going to try to do in these 10, 15 minutes, really, is say, what just happened out there in the world? We have this mythical economic recovery that they keep talking about. There is the constant threat that we're, you know, going to blow up a planet any second now. We've been confronted with corruption on a scale and with a severity. And it doesn't matter where you live in the world. There's this strange new beast that Justin and I spent some part of the day today talking about, which is this weird new world where all kinds of interesting things are happening. There's the backlash, the really extreme pushback against civil society in almost every part of the world. This is no longer a problem of a few rogue regimes run by evil dictators in third world countries. The pushback is now global. It's in the north as much as in the south. It takes different forms. But at Civicus, for example, we have a program called Civil Society Watch, and Civil Society Watch has tracked 90 countries over the last 2 years that have passed new legislation or implemented new policies that have the effect of constraining the right to dissent, the freedom of association, the freedom of expression. And then we've had ash clouds and other things that came out of the blue. This is, there's this forum called the World Economic Forum, right? These are these rich white dudes that meet in Davos every year and they try to figure out the state of the world. One of the things they do each year is put out a risk report. This is their mapping of risks at the beginning of 2011. What they measure on the horizontal axis is the likelihood of this thing happening, and on the vertical axis is its perceived impact. So you have out there fiscal crisis, geopolitical conflict, climate change, energy prices, economic disparity, global governance, water security. Out there, both extremely likely and with very high impact should they occur. The next one is even more complicated, but what it does is it tries to connect these things up. It says which risk impacts what other risks. So where are the domino effects in effect? And they concluded the world is in no position to face major new shocks. This was in January, before Japan, before what happened in the Middle East, before the latest round of food price increases. The financial crisis, they said, has reduced global economic resilience while increasing geopolitical tension, and heightened social concerns suggest that both governments and societies are less able than ever to cope with global challenges. Yet we face ever greater concerns regarding global risks, the prospect of rapid contagion through increasingly connected systems, and the threat of disastrous impacts. Two risks, they said, were especially significant, given their high degree of impact and interconnectedness: economic disparity and global governance failures, simply because they connect to more other risks than any others. They also contribute, they said, to global social fragmentation, with different groups within countries having divergent economic interests. And this is something that's been, I think, in the headlines here in Ireland, this whole notion of pitting one group of relatively marginalized people, perhaps based here, with another group of relatively marginalized people, perhaps somewhere else. The attempt, in a sense, to distract us from the main conflict, which is between relatively disparaged people anywhere and the people that got us into this mess in the first place. They said also the transnational associations are perhaps becoming more important than group identity or individual identity. I'm going to skip through this, but really at the root of much of what we're dealing with is the fact that we don't have mechanisms to resolve these crises. The global governance scenario is, somebody called it G0. It's not G7 or G8 or G20 or G194. It's G0. Because the Americans, we know, are now out to lunch till they elect another president. Europe has decided that you guys have enough internal problems of your own and the rest of us don't matter. China and India have said very categorically that they're not ready to take a position on the global, on any global issue. They've got domestic issues to deal with that are far bigger. So we're really not in a problem so much of that. We have all these different problems, climate, disparity, conflict, etc. But that we don't have any forum or working methodology to resolve any of them anytime soon. What they said was that if this is going to get combated, we need to counterbalance it with a well-informed, well-mobilized global public opinion that shares norms and values of global citizenship. But sadly, this is not yet fully developed. This is the stuff that we guys do, right? The creating the well-informed, well-mobilized public opinion. This is our area of expertise. So what have we been doing? We've been combating, on the one hand, the what I call a triple whammy of, first, the resource crunch, because it doesn't matter where you got your money from, whether it was government, private philanthropy, or the public, all sources are down. At a time when demand for our services, whatever they may be, whether you run an orphanage or whether you do advocacy, the demand for your services is spiking. And while everybody is facing a resource crunch, if you're actually working in those areas where progress, achievement, impact is hard to measure, or that is slow in coming, then you've been particularly disproportionately hit. And then there's the geopolitics that I mentioned, which is across the world now, given this power shift, even 5 years ago, governments were willing to call out other governments for human rights abuses, for example. Today, if you as a government control access to either capital or markets or natural resources, especially energy resources, you can do what you want and nobody is going to call you out. If you look at what's happening in Central Asia with human rights, for example, as long as Europe decides, Western Europe decides, that it's more important to liberate Western Europe from Mr. Putin and his gas, the people of Kazakhstan, of Turkmenistan, etc., are not going to get anywhere near the sort of solidarity that they might have got 5 years ago. We've also, I think, been blindsided by reason. You know, when the financial crisis happened, any reasonable person thought, well, now they'll get it. And so we assumed almost that things would change. So it was maybe we were, you know, counting too much on rationality. But we've also been blindsided by our embeddedness in these corridors of power, by being as dependent as we are for funding, as dependent as we are for our access. Somewhere we, in a sense, have lost the degree of independence that perhaps would allow us to challenge what's been going on. And habit. Many of us are simply more comfortable doing what we've always done rather than seeking radical new ways to do things. But all of us have drunk the Kool-Aid, if you will, of this notion, this worldview that I call Homo economicus, where the only things that are worth doing are the measure of everything is money. So all of us as human beings, apparently, we are told, are these rational bean-counting creatures that spend every waking moment, possibly even sleeping moments, you know, relentlessly calculating what the most optimum financial status that we can aspire to is. And we're not connected to each other. And we don't place any value in anything that goes beyond immediate financial gain. So for civil society, in a sense, it's been a bit of a muddled time. And then, of course, we have our own peculiar ways of confusing ourselves. So if you, like me, look back on 2010 and felt utter despair, they are not alone. But then 2011 happened, and in the space of a few short weeks, the world changed again. There was what happened in the Middle East and North Africa. And it's like a virus that has spread to almost every part of the world I know. If you look at what's happening in Spain, if you look at what's happening in my country, India, if you look at what's happening in many, many parts of Africa, including places where this sort of action comes at risk of life and limb, places like Zimbabwe, places like Ethiopia, places like Uganda, there is a new belief that things can change. There is a new belief in citizen action. In fact, there is a belief that nothing will change things except citizen action. And there is what we're calling a politicization or a repoliticization, especially of young people. This is that generation that many of us have written off as being too narcissistic, too self-centered, too occupied with their video games to give a damn. And yet they're the ones who are out there on the street. I was part of a teleconference with some of our partners in the Middle East. And there was this young Tunisian woman who was railing and ranting at the other people on the phone, saying, what are you guys doing? Why aren't you out there protesting and getting on with it? And there was this middle-aged NGO from Egypt, middle-aged man who runs an NGO in Egypt, who says, you don't get it. Till this morning, I didn't think I had a choice on what to eat for breakfast. And now suddenly you want me to get out there and start rewriting constitutions. So it's young people who really aren't burdened with the legacies and the baggage that many of us carry that are out there showing the way. Paul Rogers claims that there is every likelihood that we could actually see this movement become as large and as significant as the anti-colonial movements of the 50s and 60s. But here I think are a few things that have fundamentally changed. This is no longer, I believe, a battle between, you know, this religious group and that religious group, or between this block of countries and that block of countries, or between this economic model and the other. What we're dealing with in every aspect of our lives, from families to organizations to nation states and to the world at large, is people who believe in principle of consent, of governance by consent, and people who believe in governance by control. The second thing that I think has changed is that the single most valuable currency that you can own at this point in time, whether you're a government, a business, a media house, or a civil society player, is trust. And what we do know is that civil society around the world enjoys higher trust levels than any other sector. And my question to us is, what are we doing with that asset? The third thing I think that recent events have taught us is humility. Because all of us were taken by surprise by what happened, and that shouldn't have been if we actually knew what we were doing, if we were actually in touch with what was happening, what people were feeling and thinking. I think the other fourth thing that has changed is that change is much more about human political processes than about technocratic solutions. So it's not about how many bed nets or malaria vaccines or what, all of those are useful and good. But they're useless without the political change that accompanies them. And for many of us, we've tried to keep this sanitary distance from politics, and we've suffered for it. And clearly, I think, in terms of the model itself, complementing, supplementing, amplifying, enabling, and connecting is what it's all about. Somebody here used the metaphor of an iPhone. Was it you, Hans? That perhaps our role really as civil society organizations, networks, platforms, is not to be the provider of things, but to be the host, the platform on which many different people can run their apps. And then people choose then what apps are relevant or not. So I want to leave you, Anya asked me to be provocative. So I want to leave you with a few questions. Are we too afraid to think really, really big? Are we maybe a little too arrogant to start really, really small? Are we too expert to genuinely listen and learn? Are we too selfish to relinquish authorship and control, even if the price of doing that or the gains from doing that would be massive increases in impact? Are we too cynical to trust each other in particular and to trust the communities that we work with? Are we too egotistical to admit error or ignorance, and we keep doing the same thing that we've always done simply because to admit that we were wrong is unthinkable? Because the challenge right now is that the combination of those traits makes us too myopic to make history. What we're looking at here in Ireland, I think, as much as anywhere else, is renegotiating the social contract. This is not about clawing back some things that we think we're about to lose, or defending things that we've had for some time. It's really about state, market, and civil society getting around a table and redefining what kind of people, what kind of society we want to be. And then doing that as well at the global level and evolving a global politics that can actually manage global economics, global security threats, global climate change, global pandemics, and all the rest of it. We're in that unique position, I think, for the first time, certainly in my lifetime, of actually being able to define the future rather than simply reacting to it. The question, I think, is what do we want to do with that opportunity?